today. And it's about 8 o'clock, quarter till 12 in the evening, quarter to 8 in the evening. And the subject for the third time is the present state of the Lord's testimony. I'm going to finish this as quickly as I can. But now we're into not only the present state of Christians outside the institutional church, but also the status of Christians inside the institutional church. Now, some of you are going to say, Gene, this is not what the institutional church is really like. You got into an exceptional situation. No, that's not true. The institutional church will kill you if you threaten them. If they don't actually kill you, they can at least make life a little interesting. I think I ended. In fact, where did I end?
I'm not sure.
You're not real sure.
I think you ended. You're done now with it.
Okay. Thank you.
The what?
The other
people. Okay, because I don't know those people. The last thing I ever knew was Eldon Hall. Never knew that word. I really didn't. It's okay. No problem.
Well,
when Isla Vista got big enough that it could be seen and known and heard, and these folks were getting ready to go out on a migration.
That was germ. We know them.
This gentleman called a meeting of every church in the United States. And he traveled to every one of them. And his one and sole purpose was to attack me. Now, honestly, you got to believe that. You really have to believe that. And so word became coming back to me that this was happening. And it didn't particularly bother me. But one of the things that I have tried to do is to be submissive. And when you find somebody, it's really going to hurt them if you don't do what they ask them to. I did something very foolish, and I should not have done it. And so many people said to me, Gene, why on earth did you submit yourself to this? You knew what was going to happen. But Bob Emery said, Gene, the Bible says, and you have something against someone, somebody has something against you, you're going to go see them.
So, I wrote this gentleman a letter.
And you could not send telegrams. The telegraph company was on strike for the only time in my memory. And I found someone who would type it up. It was about 4 pages long, and it was a masterpiece of diplomacy. And it started off with, Dear Brother. But the envelope, which was the envelope I had scratched out to take with me to the Western Union, the person who typed it up took that envelope and put the letter in it. And left out one word, brother. And so I wrote him and asked if I could meet with him. And so they were having a huge conference in a place called Embassy Hotel. And I don't know how many. Mike, were you there that day? You were there. How many people? Okay. But boy, if ever in my life anybody wants to do a huge oil painting of an incident in my life, this is the one I want. I got a hold of Bob Emery, and I'll never forgive him. And I said to Lance, "Lance, come with me, but I need two witnesses. Bob, have somebody else come with me? Can you come?" He said, "I'll see." I said, "Well, if you don't let John Braun go." So who shows up? Lance Dahlander and John Braun, who had at that time been the leader of this, honchos is what they call one another, and he had just arrived, and he was in really bad shape, but he was getting better. That group, they called it the Grace Movement, had just destroyed itself in drinking, swearing,
you sure those things are not owned? Are they not owned?
The little doohickeys.
Okay.
And immorality. It was their way of showing their freedom in Christ. There was an entire movement that was shipwrecked. They were scattered all over America. And I got a phone call saying that John had lost his mind. And would we please receive him and help him?
If I ever had one thing in this life I could take back from my entire life, I would have said no to that. I literally, that day, I said yes. I founded a denomination. I have been part of the founding of two denominations who at one time in their existence existed solely for the purpose of attacking me. Now, I'm telling you something. With luck like that, you don't need friends at all. Now, you can't believe that, but it's honest truth. So I went to the Embassy Hotel to make sure I was at the right place. I stopped, opened the door, walked in, saw their book table, turned around, walked out. There was a rumor within 10 minutes of my walking in and walking out that Gene Edwards had come to spy on this group. And I'm trying to give you some idea of the paranoia with which these people live in an unreal world. So the next hour or two, or maybe it was the next morning, I'm not real sure, I came in with Lance and John Braun. And the meeting was meat. The brother spent, he saw me in the audience. He knew I was coming. He had been alerted. I was there to see if I could sit down and talk with him. Now, y'all, this is the present status of the testimony of God. Are you clear? He stood there and called people out of the audience to speak against me. And there's no way for me to communicate this, but they believed in calling on the name of the Lord, but ooh, boy. It had become a scalping cry, a war cry, if you please, a war dance. Mike, just shake your head yes. And when they got through with this orgy of attacks on me, then they went into one of these, "Oh Lord Jesus," and it just reverberates, and it's a screaming match. And it was over, and I went to the front to see if I could reconcile. Oh, I didn't need her. I knew good and well I was going to get lynched, and there was all there was to it. That's why I was there. Bob Emery, it was for you, a 21 or 22-year-old kid who didn't have good sense. I send you my love, but that was, you have to understand that there is no human being on earth who can argue with this man. It cannot be done. No human has ever tried it and come out with any way but being steamrolled and squashed. Now, I was very aware of that. So we sat down, and there was the stage, and he faced me. We were at the foot of the stage. I sat there facing him, my knees together with his knees. They were not any more than that far apart. On the stage was virtually every man in that building. They had packed that thing out. And, you know, I was an enemy, and he was their hero. And so we sat down, and he tried to start rehearsing, and he said, "We'll ask you this question."
Never answer that question. Do not answer a question.
And I said, "Brother, I'm here just to see if there's some time that you and I can get together and see if we can come to peace or reconciliation, or if not, at least leave on friendly terms."
He was very upset because there was a church in Santa Barbara. And he also was upset because he heard that it was better than his churches. And he was just upset. And we had two men's wills locked in, just locked. And this must have gone 30 or 40 minutes. "No, brother, I just would like to sit down and meet with you." And all these people standing there. It was interesting. And it's the only thing I'd say to him. "I just came here to, well, brother, we want to talk to you." "My room." "Well, nope. I just want to see if you and I can get together and talk." When we finished, I felt, thank God, finally, it's behind me. He said he would meet with me Monday. I think that was Saturday morning. I'm pretty sure it was Saturday morning. And when we stood up, I had the only vision I ever had in my life. He stood up and turned. And John Braun, at the very moment, stood up and turned toward me. "I have just traded one slaughter for another one." I turned to go, and he came to me, and he said, "Gene," though he always called me brother, "Brother Gene, I have a question, a request to make of you." This was in August of 1971. He said, "I ask you to never, ever again preach anything you ever learned from me." And I said, "Brother, I'll take you up on that." He had no idea what he did that day. Because from that moment on, it was higher ground. And I turned to go, and there was a long, long aisle up to the front, and I knew that every eye on there was going to be watching how I left there. And you know, Mike, it turned out just exactly the way I felt. I made sure how I walked out of that room. And later, and before the day was over, they were saying he walked out of there like a snake slithering down the aisle. This is true. I'm not exaggerating anything. In fact, I'm being kind. Well, you've never seen me do a Blackie Edwards, John Wayne walk. I mean, it would make strong men pass out. If you ever see me get angry and I'm walking, you'll see it. But I'm not going to try to illustrate it to you. I walked out of there. Well, I don't have enough room. takes about 20 feet to get started.
You never told me I had to bring my rubber booty. Get out of beat me, Harry.
That was Saturday morning. I got back to Isla Vista, and there was a whole bunch of people there on Sunday morning to hear him. And the first thing he did was when he stood up was said, I am not going to meet with Gene Edwards.
I'm sorry?
That was the meeting I was at. I wasn't here. That was the meeting I was at. I wasn't
messy. Okay. And I understand he did a pretty good job there that morning. Somebody wrote and asked for the tape, which they always distributed, and they wanted a copy of it. And of the Sunday morning meeting, and somebody was really thrilled. They were going to send it out. They thought, oh, this is a wonderful tape. You're really going to enjoy it. Somebody stopped it, and that tape was never distributed by anyone. I sat there with this incredible man, and if you please, this giant of a man. And I was as calm and as unperturbed as I could be. But that morning, I did not drive back to Santa Barbara. I drove out about halfway and I checked it to a motel. And I cried the rest of the afternoon, the evening, and the next morning. All those emotions of all those days can't turn loose. And I'm weeks and months and years. There was hardly a month passed, maybe two or three, and a word would reach me that these folks were going to send an entire church to establish a church in Santa Barbara. Why they did not, I will never know. But it was a mercy of God. That's one thing we did not have to deal with. And I don't know what on earth we would have done. I seriously thought about asking the brothers and sisters in Santa Barbara to shut down and go join the local church. Sorry. The Eldon Hall group. For the sake of oneness. To stop this bloodletting. And I called Stephen Kong. And I was crying. And I said, Stephen, I have never wished any harm for him nor his work. And I don't know what to do. Now, have you ever had an experience where somebody gives you a sentence that's something like, apples are red, or the wind is blowing, and it hits you like a truck hitting you? I was crying almost incoherently. And I said, Brother Stephen, I don't know what to do. Now, those two men had long since divided. Now, Stephen Kong is, the first cousin of Watchman Nee. Kin, some way. I'm sorry. Yeah. And then there was the other brother, and they had served together for years in China. And Brother Stephen, always the gentleman. He said, Gene, there comes a moment in your life when you have to follow God and not man. And I had been so committed to peace, unity, that I felt like that had never crossed my mind. And I started bawling, and I said, thank you, and I hung up. And that was pretty much it. I will tell you, this legendary story that I was working with a group of Christians in Dallas. The brother who was more or less started the group was a gentleman named Caleb McAfee. He's still a very dear friend. And this story has been told from so many viewpoints, I'd like to tell you what happened. They had met, and this group had a group in Dallas. And they came into the group I was working with and said, we want to be one with you. And we want to just all go in together just on the grounds of Jesus Christ and nothing else. And Caleb said, no. Oh, did I tell you about the letter and the word brother was missing and how they...
No, letter or not.
They went, hit the roof. It was everywhere in America. He didn't put the word B-R-O in front of the envelope. And, it was like the Holocaust. We're not going to be like this.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Caleb asked me to come to Dallas. I'm still being a fool. So I got on the plane
with John Braun.
And Caleb asked me to meet with the two groups and see if they couldn't do something that was peaceful. Because these people had gotten so outraged because someone said they didn't want to meet on the grounds of oneness and unity. And they go berserk. Then Caleb asked me to go and meet in the room where the two groups were meeting. And I walked in. And they were meeting, and they started their ritual. And the other brothers and sisters were there, rather kind of lost at it all. I sat down by who I do not know, but that woman later said, when I sat down by Gene Edwards, I felt so filthy. And I listened, and about 5 minutes later, somebody got on the phone. You could see them getting on the phone, and a few minutes later, the Dallas leader walked in, and his name is Bill Free. No, it's Bill Freeman.
Bill Freeman.
Wasn't Ben?
Huh?
Wasn't Ben. Bill.
No, it was
Bill
Freeman at that moment. And the meeting ended, and I was about to go out to say something to Caleb, and Bill Freeman started in on me, almost in a cadence. And I want to get this record straight. There was this blackboard. I did not say one word at any time in that room. You know, there are some things God has to forgive me of. I went over to that blackboard, and I wrote one word. When I wrote it, I knew that you would be back in Los Angeles within 30 minutes. And the word was Ichabod. And I put down there September 1, 1971. And I turned around, walked out, and we got outside and they began screaming. And their screaming was it was just unreal. And I kept hearing, yes, it's Ichabod, and they were talking about me. That was not exactly the message I wished to
Ichabod was here.
Convey. And I turned to Caleb and said, Caleb, y'all have to stop me. And everybody stood there on the sidewalk, and they were hearing all of this stuff. And they all had their heads down, and that was a defeated bunch of people. I had not said that yet, by the way, to Caleb. And I looked at them, and I thought, how sad that they have been bruised by this. And I said, the natives are rather restless tonight, aren't they? And everybody looked up and smiled.
the group I was with. We got in the car and I said, Caleb, you have to stop meeting. And they did.
And I've never been back to Dallas, Texas.
I'm looking for Atlanta. Arlington.
Where are you? Yet. Walked out of there. And I continued being... I became the blamer of all things that ever went wrong with that group. I'd say for 10 years until that gentleman named...
J.E. Okay,
No, somebody who was with him and left. Big guy.
Thunderous. Oh, man.
Max Rappaport.
Yeah.
I was the whipping boy until Max left.
Yeah.
And then I got free.
Yeah.
So if you've ever read The Animal Farm by George Orwell, there's Napoleon, who's the leader of the farm. He took it over, and she ran Snowball out. But anytime anything went wrong, it was Snowball who did it, according to Apulia. Well, for about 5, 6, or 7 years, I was Snowball. I had nothing to do with them, but I was coming back to me all the time. Were they out of problem over here? That was Snowball. I would do leopards.
Oh, boy. Now,
you answer this question for me. Was that an act of cowardice on my part?
Was it a neutral thing, or did it take courage?
And the answer is, I am the only man in this world, and he knew when he left, and I knew it, and he knew it, I knew it, and he knew that I knew it, or whatever. I'm the first and only human being
who ever survived that man.
But John Braun, who would have ripped a hole in that meeting that day if it had been him, saw me as a weak person. And I just traded one problem for another. It's a long time ago. Something you don't know. I don't think my wife knows. And Mike, you don't know. Witness Lee contacted me and challenged me to a debate.
Really?
And he said, however many brothers you have, I'll have that many brothers present. And we'll debate. I'll speak and you'll speak. And we'll debate.
When was that?
A few days later.
Oh, you mean that
1971. There were a couple of men that got wind of that and said, Gene, go debate him. And it reminded me when I was a young pastor of a town not too far from where I was a pastor. There was no Baptist church and no Methodist church. And it was big enough to have both. But they had had a debate between a Baptist and a Methodist minister back in the 1920s. And that was in the 1950s. And you could stop at the candy store there. And within 5 minutes, they'd be telling you about that debate. Everybody in that town was totally divided. It just about killed Lindsay. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I said no.
I'm going to tell you why, Mike. It's because I would have won that debate. And there is no way in this world anybody in the world knows that but me.
Sometimes in privacy, I will tell you why I would have won that debate. Mike, that would have been the most gosh awful demonstration of the flesh this world could possibly see between two men in Christ.
No.
Now I'm going to jump ahead to year 1975. the Far East again. I was there in 65. I was there in 75. I went there to get some, to rescue some Christians who were out in the jungles. And I got a phone call saying, somebody's got to come get these people. They're going to be destroyed by the Viet Cong, the Viet Thai, and the Viet Lao. And I took the challenge, and that's another story. But when I got off the plane, I landed first in Hong Kong. Can you remember what I just told you earlier about what I had seen in 1965? When I arrived there in 1975, Brother James Chen, who was more or less the, not only sort of a pastor of that whole church, but he was the whole Hong Kong area in there belonged to him. James Chen and Brother Wei went into court and were tied up for years as to who owned that building. And it was big, and it was beautiful, and it was ugly, and it was vicious. And there was a day when one group was meeting and the other group, and they ran over time, and the other group came into the building to use the church building, and the two groups met, and a fist fight broke out. In fact, it was a young riot. And that's the present status of the testimony of God on this earth. And as far as I know, there are two churches in every city where there was one little flock church in every place in Asia. And the carnage has been absolutely unbelievable. And then the same thing came over to the United States. Brother Michael, I believe you are aware of some of that. Now, I heard something real interesting. You've just been over at, what's the name of the town you're in, Raleigh? Raleigh, Durham. And there are two groups. Two?
Oh.
There are three.
There was a group in Raleigh, a group in Durham, and they both just went, so there's four.
There are four. And all of them are meeting on the grounds of oneness and locality. Four churches in Raleigh, Durham.
Tell them Gene sends his love.
Oh, well.
See.
Well, praise the Lord.
No, just didn't have to get Nico.
Story ends. A few years ago, I was in California, and I met with Doug Krieger. I love him. He was 19 years old the day that I met these people. And he was now gray-headed, sort of. And he said, Gene, you were so wise to get out of there when you did. Well, I'm not sure whether I got to the door first or they got me out the door first. It was a foot race. But he said, Gene, you cannot imagine how many nervous breakdowns there have been, how many divorces there have been, and how many destroyed Christians there have been since this movement was started. And I am telling you that some of the things, if I told you that those people had done, you would say to me, that cannot be true. Christians would not do that. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I can tell you what happened, what somebody said in that meeting in Dallas that night. One of them said, if Gene Edwards walks into this room, I'm going to break both his legs. I never met him. That's the present status of the God's testimony on the earth this year. Now, I'm envying that story permanently. Now, it seems strange today, and you're just going to have to, you're going to have to be very understanding that I made a statement, I made a vow that I would never criticize that man as long as I live. And I think that finally came clear to them because I did not whimper. And then I heard he died. And now I'm about to die. According to this verse scripture I read, I am about to die anyway, you mathematically sure in focus and are. And now this is the record that I'm leaving you of the present, the status of the present testimony of God, people on this earth. And I would say, it's not God's testimony. We don't have one. And quite frankly, I'm not sure we've had one since the Plymouth Brethren stepped to the stage with all the things they have done. But the carnage that has been raked by these people even overshadows what has gone on between the Plymouth Brethren. That leaves two other groups of Christians who made it to the 20th century. And that's Brother Bok Singh and Brother Prem Pradhan, one from India and one from Nepal. What shall we say of Brother Prem Pradhan, Brother Bok Singh? I never met him. But I made sure that his people came and visited us in Santa Barbara. I'm wondering, Paul, do you and the four of you, can you remember their visit with us? You don't. You don't remember a group of Christians every time someone said pray, they dropped to their knees. Alicia, do you remember their visit with us?
Alicia?
I don't mean there, but I just remember our group of people that went there.
We went there, and they came here. They were with us one weekend. Well, this brother, you ought to remember this meeting. This brother got up, he just got there, and he rebuked us for not witnessing. And I mean, he really ripped us to shreds. This is what his message he brought to us. And he sat down, and man, that room was too silent. And I walked up to the front and I said to him, sir, this afternoon you will lead this church out on the beaches and you will show us how to witness in the beaches. He didn't know that we were loaded for bear. And we went out that afternoon and he led us. And by the way, he privately apologized to me later for having done that. We got out there and we went up one side of those beaches, back down the same side of that beaches, witnessing to people. And I think we brought a few folks in that night that we'd led to the Lord. They're very evangelistic. Prem Bok Singh is hands down and walking away the most successful Christian worker outside of institutional Christianity since the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Paul. Recently, when he died, the funeral was attended by 600,000 people, according to Christianity Today. And the picture that was taken from an airplane was unbelievable. This is eyes, as far as the eyes can see. 60,000 churches in one man's lifetime. Most of them in the province, in and around Hyderabad. That's a pretty good status, Gene. Only problem is that we never saw those people. He had five co-workers. You're going to meet one of them. He's been a friend of mine for many, many years. And if we can ever rake up $500 or $600 around here, I'm gonna invite him in here. And his name is Koshi, and he's going to tell you the whole story. I have nothing to say to you about these people. They were and still are awesome. But I will tell you this. To my knowledge, and I think I'm correct, and I think maybe I'm one book off, in his entire lifetime, Bok Singh wrote two pamphlets. One is entitled David Recovered All, about 60 pages long. And there's another one, but I'm not sure the name of it. It may just be one, But that's it. Nothing. And I think I would like to take a little credit for the fact that his biography has just appeared, because I asked Brother Koshy to come to my home in Maine and sit down with me, and exhorted him to on the phone to get this biography written. And we had a nice long meeting for about a week, and I told him how to write. And he just published a few days ago the biography of Bok Sing. It's 450 pages long. And that's it. And that's a great work. But I will have to say it was purely evangelism. But I have to also say he was a churchman. 60,000 churches. And what about prayer? I could fall on my knees in front of that man just by using his name. I don't think I'll ever forgive you, Mike.
Cut the tape, Mom.
Both film came to visit us in Santa Barbara. Y'all remember Hill? Absolutely. And then he came to visit the church in Atlanta, and he stayed in the home of Mike Rooney. I was absolutely mortified beyond all mortification when I found out that Prem Pradhan had slept on the floor in the living room while he was our guest.
Told everything. And then a weekend before, we just told everything.
You didn't have anything in the house.
Let me tell you something. That was Prem Pradhan's bedroom.
Well,
absolutely. I'm still angry with Prem. He died. He died of a massive something internally. He never wrote a book. And the only messages he ever bought that were recorded by us. I don't know of any man who has ever lived, including the Apostle Paul, who has ever been persecuted as that man has been. His testimony, absolutely unbelievable. The work died with him. It doesn't exist. It was taken over by institutional churches. They bought off his people, paying them $200 a year because they've been making $75 a year. I consider it one of the greatest works of God in the history of Christendom. One of the greatest men that ever breathed there. I'm going to tell you something else. I was going through some real crucibles, and I met with Prem in Fort someplace in Canada, right over the border, and a lot of brothers came over, about 10 or 12 brothers, to meet him while he was there. And Prem made the same decision I'd made, and that was to never own anything in my own name. And he owned nothing in his name. And he trusted his closest friend and Christian devotee. And they owned one of the choicest pieces of property in all of Kathmandu. It was two blocks away from the palace of the king. And he had just received word a few weeks ago that this man had taken the property and sold it, put it in his pocket, and went to a Hindu temple and renewed his Hindu vows. And I was in a situation that was virtually identical, trusting someone else with God's money. But I'm not going to tell you that story. But we sat down, and he was crying, and I was crying. And I said, "Pray on." He was trying to figure out a way to raise $100,000 to buy it back. And he had asked everybody to just put everything on hold. And I said, pray him. You've got to give it up. And I didn't know what that man was made out of, because I was going through exactly the same situation he was.
and I had yielded. No fighting.
The next morning, about 6 a.m., we met. I think it was in my hotel room. I call Nepal. Just now, I told them, give property up. We're not going to fight. And I could have fallen at that man's feet and kissed them, because I just met somebody who wouldn't fight. And we were both just shell-shocked, and we were both down, and we were, it was the lowest point of my ministry. And I said, you going to quit?
I said, I never quit.
I said, all right, I'm making a deal with you, Prem. I'll quit the day after you do. He said, you never quit. I never will quit. Do you know a few moments like that in your life can make the difference of nightmares and walks through hell for just a few bright minutes? I hold him in higher esteem than any other man on this earth. I'm sorry the work's gone. We were scheduled, if I could ever just get well, we were scheduled to go to Nepal, and I was supposed to teach his people, their workers. And we were going to live in a riverbed, boil water, eat rice, and riverbed. Well, that's where he's told us he held his conferences, in riverbed, very old conference in riverbed. No idea what that means. I think I was already praying it would be in a time of the drought. And he died on me. We got two really good people. One's work is over. His testimony is over, except that it lives in my heart. And the other one is laid over in India, and it doesn't fit anything that you would ever want to be born of. Honest. You get tired of hitting your knees 10, 15 times a day every time somebody said pray. They have some strange eccentricities. It's not a criticism, but I tell you, that man had a way to raise money like nothing anyone in this world. Every time he was at a church, he put an offering box right beside him. This is boxing. Everybody would start over here, and they'd come by in single file. He'd stand there and wait till every one of them put money in that box. All the way back, circle back to where their chair was. And as far as I know, they still do that. Now then, I have received a tentative engagement to be in northern India this October or next October to be at one of those things they call a convocation. And they usually about 50,000 people show up for that thing, and he has asked me to be the speaker. Do you think I don't want to go there? I'd give my eye teeth and some other things, but I don't see any way in this world I can ever get there. But I do want you to know that I respect those people and love them, and if there's anything that we can learn from those folks, we'll learn. Now, let me very quickly switch over to the very injured man who came to be with us. And he was a leader, and his people followed him, and we looked up a few weeks after he arrived and began to get well. We had 100 new people
in the church, and they were all his followers. He saw my weakness. And by the way, it's a well-known weakness. And he's not the first person to ever take advantage of it. It has become almost standard issue among many people. They find out that I won't fight, and they just do all sorts of unbelievable things. One day they announced that they were taking over the church in Santa Barbara. I figured it out before they announced it, and I knew it was going to be a bloodletting. And I had dinner with Lance Thollander at the tea house, and I said, Mike, I said, Lance, you don't know this, but as I walk out this door, they're going to split the church. And I'm leaving, and I'm going to find out if I built with wood, whole hay and stubble, or gold and silver and precious stone. And can you tell me, Alicia, approximately how old you might have been at that time? That would have been 1972.
1972? Well, about 24.
Okay. Are you one of the younger, or are you wanted to be older?
I was the average age of everybody.
You were one?
Everybody's my age.
Everybody was 24. So we got 23 and 24.
Do you understand that I got up and left? Do you understand I packed my bags in April? And those men were ruthless beyond anything you could imagine. Now, this is the institution church. And when I got there, they began to go from house to house, telling everybody that they had rights to this church because John had one preached there at one time, and that they were taking over the church, and Gene left because he was a coward. Same way about that snake living down the aisle. Yeah, I guess I am a coward if you've seen that I refuse to get in my flesh or to defend my ministry. They went door to door telling, I'm going to tell you what they did. They went door to door and screamed at people. And I spent the summer in Memphis, Tennessee, and I waited to see. I wanted to know. I'd only been there with those kids 2 years, and I wanted to know whether I had built stone and silver and diamonds. To my knowledge, and I believe I am correct, they stormed the church. And I came back, and they told me I would never preach in Isla Vista again as long as I lived, and if I tried, then they'd come into the meeting and haul me out. This is the true stories, folks. I don't have this kind of imagination. Well, I don't. And Phil Warmerman doesn't remember this, and I'm so sorry. He came by my house, and he said, Gene, I just arrived. He said, Gene, you're never going to preach in here again. And it was one of those beautiful Isla Vista sunsets going right down over the ocean. They're so gorgeous. And he said, if you try to preach here, they're going to come and haul you out. And I looked at that sunset, and I said, they may stop that sun from coming up tomorrow morning, but they will never stop me from preaching in Santa Augusta. And Phil shook his head and said, Gene, I think you have underestimated those men. And I said, yes, and you've underestimated my God. And so I announced the meeting. And it was the one thing they weren't prepared for. I announced the meeting would take place in my living room. And we notified the police. And told them to stand by. And I preached one of the most important messages of my life. In fact, it was a watershed for my ministry. Everything I've ever preached on since then, you can start it with that message right there. Because it had to do with the unseen realms. And there was no room anywhere. We had three bedrooms full. We had the kitchen full. We had one of those California rooms in the back. The entire backyard was packed, and there were people. They had taken the windows out of every place, and there were heads sticking in, and there were people around. There were easily 200 people within a few feet of that place. And I walked in there and preached like a man who had just fallen out of heaven. I did not in any way, shape, or form make any reference to anything. Paul, were you there?
I was there.
Alicia, were you there?
I was there.
Jean, were you there?
Yep.
Really? Fran, were you there? Yeah. Boy, that was high volume, folks. I could not move my feet. They were just right here, and I couldn't have gone 2 inches forward. Well, I would like to tell you they went home. We never saw them again, and that's sort of true. But one of the people, and I heard this, and I just got home.
That there was a man in the church who had two wives.
And I went to see him. And I have to say, Ed Snickvick, I don't know if you're still alive or not, but I owe you forever, because Ed said, "Are you still alive?"
No.
Oh, he said, "Gina won't go with you." And oh, shucks. Two what? 2 minutes? Sure, it's not 2 hours. And I walked in with Ed and stick another one in. I'm going to finish this story. It's not going to last much longer. And Ed said to the girl, "I ask you as a father, don't do this." And the young man was not only living in polygamy, he was espousing it to them.
And I said, "Steve," whatever his name was, "I'm going to fill you out of church."
He said, "No, you're not. Church is going to stand with me."
And I said, "Not that church will not." And he said, "Yes, it will."
So I called a meeting. And you talk about the Alamo. Yeah. Now, I have something to say to you, and that is, do not ever underestimate the institutional church. And you have no idea what happened after that in that community. I'm going to spare you, Gene. It got so bad, because it's not on tape. Yeah. I'm just talking to him.
Oh, okay. All right. I think we can capture the panini fit on the arm a little. You know, like do bra.
Okay, let me just go ahead and finish then. We got a meeting there where we met. And there were people there who were, in fact, I don't know how I got out that door. They had said I was a coward because I left for the summer. They were just picking anything. Saints, it doesn't matter. When people get in the flesh, they'll do anything in the world they want to do.